For Pacifica Radio, June 28th, 2020. I'm Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio. All right, y'all, welcome to the show. It is Anti-War Radio. I'm your host, Scott Horton. I'm the editorial director of antiwar.com and author of the book Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan. You can find my full interview archive at scotthorton.org. More than 5,000 of them now, going back to 2003 for you there at scotthorton.org and also at youtube.com/scotthortonshow. All right, you guys, introducing Hans Christensen from the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, and he is also at the Federation of American Scientists as well. And SIPRI, that's SIPRI.org, have just put out their latest study, the SIPRI Yearbook 2020. And part of that, of course, focuses on nuclear weapons. And they have a story here at SIPRI.org. Nuclear weapon modernization continues, but the outlook for arms control is bleak. Welcome to the show, Hans. How are you, sir?
Thanks for having me.
Very happy to have you here. So, I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to read the whole PDF file and everything here. It's been a very busy time. But I did read the introductory article here, and there's so many important points brought up here. But I guess if we could just start with reminding the audience which all countries are armed with nuclear weapons and approximately how many of them, et cetera, like that, if you could.
Yeah, so there are now nine countries today that have nuclear weapons, and that's the United States and Russia, France, Britain, China, India, Pakistan, Israel, and North Korea. And all together, they possess something in the order of 13,400 nuclear warheads. Most of those are in what you can sort of call military stockpiles that are ready to use on relatively short notice. But there's also a chunk of them, something in the order of 1,800 to 2,000 that are on high alert. They're ready to fire within just minutes.
Mm-hmm. And those are mostly America and Russia's?
The alert weapons are American, Russian, French, and British, yes.
Mm-hmm. And then is there a ratio handy about how many of these are fission bombs versus thermonuclear H-bombs?
Almost all of them are thermonuclear weapons, two-stage thermonuclear weapons. Those are the more advanced weapons that countries like the United States and Russia and France and Britain and China have developed over the years. Newer countries that have only conducted relatively few nuclear tests don't yet have that capability, India, Pakistan, and Israel, and also North Korea. Although North Korea has demonstrated in their last test that they can produce something thermonuclear, something that can produce a very high yield, but it's a little unclear whether that is a two-stage device or, you know, some other technology.
Mm-hmm. And are most of those still measured in the kilotons, or they're up into the megaton range?
No, megaton weapons are sort of becoming more and more rare. Those were things that people built early on. Now it's in the hundreds of kilotons or even tens of kilotons. So if you look at, it depends on the mission, of course, also. If countries have warheads that are intended for blowing up deeply buried underground facilities or knocking out hardened ICBMs or command structures and that type of stuff, then they tend to be higher yield because they have to, you know, do more damage. But if you're looking at weapons that are needed for sort of more warfighting scenarios, you know, against shallower targets or troop formations or bases or something like that, then you can do the job with, you know, just, you know, a few tens of kiloton.
Mm-hmm. And then now, did I hear you right that you said India does not have H-bombs?
That's correct. Although there have been claims in India that they do. And also one of the devices that was tested back in 1998 apparently was an attempt to make a thermonuclear design, but it fizzled. And so we don't anticipate that they have a two-stage thermonuclear device deployed in their arsenal.
Okay, because I had read and actually talked to an expert or two, I guess, about that one of the real problems with the nuclear standoff between India and Pakistan was that Pakistan really only had these much smaller yield tactical battlefield type nuclear weapons that they would use against an armored column or something like that, but that the Indians had focused on building higher yield strategic nuclear weapons for killing cities with and this kind of thing, and that because their armor was so disparately matched as well, that if the Indians launched a conventional attack, the Pakistanis might have to use low-yield nukes to defend themselves, and then the Indians would have no choice but to retaliate with genocidal weapons of destruction, because that's essentially all they have, something like that. But so I wonder about how you conceive of that whole scenario there.
Well, the scenario borrows a little about different aspects of the reality. It's too simplistic, though. The point is that both countries have developed medium-range ballistic missiles with, you know, warheads in several tens of kilotons that can hit each other's cities. But what's unique about Pakistan is that in addition to that, they have also developed weapons that are more tactical and appear to be intended for use against, like you mentioned, Indian conventional forces massing inside Pakistan territory. So that's a unique feature of the Pakistani arsenal. And that, of course, leads to a lot of concern about, you know, how they're going to do that. Or are they going to delegate launch authority to the local units so they could use them early if necessary? How is that going to play out? So there are differences between the arsenals, but there are also a lot of similarities. Mm-hmm.
So I guess the numbers of Chinese nukes are happily surprisingly low here in the triple digits.
They're compared to the US and Russia, of course, they're very low.
It's enough to kill us all. I mean, but yeah.
Yeah, no, the Chinese have had a different approach to their deterrent posture for many decades. They basically didn't buy into the using of nuclear weapons in sort of warfighting scenarios. They thought if they had, you know, a few hundred, 100, 200, whatever, in a posture where they were, where they could retaliate, they could not be knocked out. So they would always be available to retaliate. That should be enough, they thought, for nuclear deterrence. What we're seeing now, of course, is that China is increasing its arsenal. We have bumped up the number this year to 320 warheads that we estimate are in this their stockpile. And it's increasing, but it has been increasing for a long time, just sort of slowly. Now we'll have to see if they're going to, you know, increase faster. But whatever they're doing, they're not sprinting to parity. It's not like whatever you hear about the Chinese nuclear arsenal, it's not like they're trying to catch up to the Russians and the Americans. They still have a fundamentally different perspective on the role of their nuclear weapons.
Yeah. Hey, it's important to note that historically speaking, at the height of the Cold War, there were tens of thousands, 40,000 approximately, yeah, on the American and Soviet Union side each. And so we've made a lot of progress since then, right?
That's correct, yeah. At the peak in the mid-1980s, there was 70,000 nuclear weapons. And on both the Russian and American side, 10,000 of those were on high alert, ready to go in, you know, within a few minutes. And just totally crazy circumstances. And so, of course, when the Cold War ended, they started slicing a lot of that excess capacity out. And so we saw a huge drop there in the early 1990s and also a little later on. But what we're now beginning to see is that the two sides are sort of, you know, slowing down significantly and even to some extent reversing that trend and looking to maintain significant arsenals for the indefinite future. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, all sides are sort of increasing the value they say that they attribute to nuclear weapons. They're increasing the role of the nuclear weapons and the way they talk about what functions they should serve. So this is a very troublesome development.
And I'm sorry, what did you say the number was at the height? I thought it was much higher.
70,000.
Oh, 70. I'm sorry. I thought you said 17, and I thought, wow, I was way off. Yeah, no, that's more like what I thought it was. 70,000 nukes.
Yeah, it was crazy. I mean, you can imagine, you can just imagine spending a couple of hours on Google Earth and trying to put 70,000 X's on the map. Right. I mean, what were you going to do with all that stuff? Right. So
yeah, there's an anecdote about Dick Cheney back in 1989 when he was first Secretary of Defense, being shown, I guess, on the computer screen a simulation of what it would look like, where they just nuke Moscow hundreds of times over, and Dick Cheney finally says, "That's enough, turn this off," and wanted it redone because it was just completely insane. And of course, he's notoriously the greatest American hawk alive. Right?
Yeah, it's ironic that you can find some of those realizations in what some characters like Cheney did. And he sent one of his officials, Frank Miller, out to Strategic Air Command, as it was called, or STRATCOM, as it now is known. And they went through the entire targeting list. There, you know, it's a very, very important anecdote or reading of that episode in the memoirs of one of the first of the first STRATCOM commander. So that was just, they discovered, not surprisingly, that there was an enormous overkill because the nuclear planners had been allowed to essentially do this by themselves with very little oversight. And so things have changed since then, also in the oversight. But even that, even though we've moved beyond some of that stuff, the nuclear planning today is still, you know, surprisingly similar to what it was during the Cold War.
Mm. Yeah, Daniel Ellsberg has talked about how, you know, a lot of it is just bureaucratic politics, where it's not fair that the Air Force gets to blow up this city where the Navy wants a crack at it too. Okay, okay, Navy, you guys can also hit it with missiles. And so it's just kind of like an episode of some sitcom, some bureaucratic politics, you know.
Yeah, there is an element of sort of institutional competition and turf wars and all this stuff that's part of it, the dynamic. And mind you, early on, the Army also had a dream that they wanted exactly 100,000 nuclear weapons, just the Army. I mean, those were crazy days.
Hey, guys, just real quick, if you listen to the interviews only feed at the Institute or at scotthorton.org, I just want to make sure you know that I do a Q&A show from time to time at scotthorton.org/show, the old whole show feed. And so if you like that kind of thing, check that out there. Hey guys, here's how to support this show. You can donate in various amounts at scotthorton.org/donate. We've got some great kickbacks for you there. Shop amazon.com by way of my link at scotthorton.org. Leave a good review for the show at iTunes and Stitcher. Tell a friend, I don't know. Oh yeah, and buy my books, Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan, and The Great Ron Paul, The Scott Horton Show Interviews 2004 through 2019. And thanks. Hey guys, check out Listen and Think audiobooks. They're at listenandthink.com and of course on audible.com. And they feature my book, Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan, as well as brand new out Inside Syria by our friend Reese Ehrlich, and a lot of other great books, mostly by libertarians there. Reese might be one exception, but essentially they're all libertarian audiobooks. And here's how you can get a lifetime subscription to Listen and Think audiobooks. Just donate $100 to The Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate. All right, so now, the Israelis. I actually had the opportunity to discuss this briefly with Mordecai Vanunu on Twitter, where confirmed to me that he stood by his original leak to the Sunday Times of London that the Israelis have 200 nukes. And I don't think he would clarify if that included H-bombs or not, but we know from Grant Smith's FOIA lawsuits and stuff that that does include H-bombs as of 1987. But anyway, so you guys here count, what, I think 90, something like that. But of course, we all know that Israel doesn't have nukes. They're completely deniable and not official and so forth. So I wonder where you come up with that number and that kind of thing.
Yeah, so that's a long history, this thing about how you come up with a number for the Israelis, because there's so little factual information about it. The way it happened back in the 80s, when Vanunu and others came out with the estimates of the Chinese arsenal, was that people looked at how their reactor had operated and calculated from that how many units, if you will, of plutonium they could have produced over the years. And then they translated that into the number of potential weapons they might have. That's how you got to those high numbers. The intelligence community, U.S. intelligence community, looked at it a little differently. They said that, yes, even though that production might have happened, they haven't turned all of that plutonium into warheads. And so their number has been much lower over the years. And so we've gone with that latter number and said, you know, those are the weapons that we think they have actually assembled, although they keep them partially unassembled under normal circumstances. And but that they have other, you know, they have more plutonium in stock that they could produce if they needed to. So that's how these differences emerge about the numbers.
Mm-hmm. And that includes second strike missiles deployed on submarines, too. And do you know how many?
Well, so that's a big uncertainty right now. There is a persistent rumor that Israel has put some cruise missiles or developed warheads for some cruise missiles on its conventional attack submarines. So we're cautiously including that in our estimate this year. And I'm just saying this because there's so little information about exactly what the Israeli arsenal includes, there's also a lot of room for speculation and rumors and even hype. And so one has to be a little careful not to get sort of swooped up in that in that kind of excitement and get to all sorts of capabilities. And you mentioned people saying that there was thermonuclear capability. Well, some people believe that. We tend not to think that the Israelis have developed a functioning two-state thermonuclear capability. We do believe they have a boosted a single-stage design, but doing that requires development of more technology. It's more complex to do, and you have to look at what is Israel's intention with its arsenal. What function does it have to serve? The reason people develop thermonuclear weapons was because their targeting strategies required them to blow up things with great explosive power. At first, that had to do with accuracy. You just couldn't hit precisely enough, so you develop large-yield thermonuclear weapons so you could compensate for the inaccuracy. But Israel is not in that situation. They have relatively accurate missiles, and so their calculation, it seems to me at least, would have to be a little different. They probably don't need these super high-yield warheads.
I'd agree with that. I don't think anybody does, but I understand what you mean. So now let's talk about North Korea a little bit here. As you said, they tested a nuke that was possibly boosted, but nobody really knows exactly for sure, right?
Yeah, the U.S. intelligence community seems to say that the last test that was about, what was it, 150, some say 200 kiloton, this uncertainty about the specific range because different agencies that monitored have put out different estimates. But it was big. It was significant. It was in a yield that you would have to either have a very large, very significantly boosted single-stage weapon or some form of thermonuclear design. We've heard that characterization from U.S. officials saying that there was some thermonuclear event involved in this. But whether that means this is a two-stage thermonuclear warhead of the kind of warheads that the United States and Russia developed over the years, that's a little more uncertain. But it was a significant nuclear yield that was produced by that weapon.
All right. So supposedly their missiles can reach DC now. I guess they reached a high enough orbit that they say it could have reached DC if that's how it had been targeted. One of those tests, maybe two of those tests. But then they also say that even if they do have H-bombs, they haven't been able to successfully miniaturize them to the point they'd be able to marry them to one of these rockets and deliver one to D.C. So we have a little bit of breathing room there. But everybody, all kinds of politicians from both parties say that that's the red line. We can never allow them to have H-bombs or, I guess, atom bombs and the means to deliver them, especially not to our capital city. Hey, the West Coast, maybe, but not D.C. But then, so I wonder if you think, like, on the timeline of their development, we know when they started making nukes, right, after they withdrew from the treaty in 03 and all of that. And so on the timeline of their progress, are you worried that they might be able to miniaturize their nukes and marry them to their missiles sometime within the next few years? Or what do you think about that?
Yeah, our sense of where they are is that they've developed ballistic missiles that can reach the U.S., but it's a little less clear whether they have a functioning warhead for those missiles that can reach the United States. And this is a distinction that's normally lost in the public discussion about the threat from North Korea. It's more likely that they have warheads that developed initially for their shorter range ballistic missile, the medium range systems that they have. So bases in the region, U.S. allies in the region, would most certainly be at risk. But like you mentioned, they made a lot of progress very quickly, and they seem to intent on continuing that. We've just heard some very strong statement from the North Koreans about continuing refining and improving their nuclear arsenal, and that's one thing we've learned from the North Korean. You can pretty much trust what they say on this issue. If they say they'll do it, that means something real. So they're not done, and we're likely to see more things coming in the future.
Okay, so now let's talk about this modernization. You know, part of this, I think, is just a welfare program for the nuclear arms industry. It was part of the negotiations in the Senate to get the new START passed under Obama was, okay, you get $1 trillion. It's now almost two. It'll probably be four by the time they're done. And so I don't know how much of this is just make work. I know that they came out. They've already deployed the new lower yield cruise missiles. But, you know, what else do we need to know about the so-called modernization here other than just the special interest aspect? But what about the actual change in the nuclear forces?
Yeah, so the bulk of the U.S. modernization program is a complete replacement of the entire arsenal. So everything that was built in this or developed and built from in the 80s and 90s is now coming up for renewal. And the commitment that has been made is that all elements of what's known as the triad, the sea-based, the land-based ballistic missiles, and the long-range bombers, all of that will be replaced. And also the shorter-range fighter jets will also be upgraded and replaced. And so in addition to this comes nuclear production facilities, expanded plutonium pit production facilities that are being planned. We see a modernization of the nuclear command and control system that's supposed to support and manage these nuclear forces. So it's a very, very broad and comprehensive modernization plan. And like you said, it's going to cost a lot of money. Now, the question is, does it change anything fundamentally compared to what we had before? And so that's the way you have to look under the hood and sort of see what kind of capabilities are being built into these new systems. Because, of course, when they built a new ICBM, it's not just a copycat of the old one. They put advanced capabilities on it and would like to improve its effectiveness. Likewise, when they upgrade a nuclear gravity bomb, for example, the B-61, that is used both by strategic bombers but also by tactical fighter wings, here in the United States and also in Europe, when they upgrade that, they don't just, you know, repaint and dust it off the one that's there. No, they improve it. So they add a guided tail kit so it can hit its target more accurately. So even though the numbers may not go up, and even though you may not have fundamentally new nuclear weapons, you take the chance to and the opportunity to improve the capabilities of the weapons they can have in the future.
Mm-hmm. All right, so what do you make of all the new hypersonics, ours and the other guys?
Well, so that's the next chapter in the arms race, of course. Everybody is on that bandwagon or trying to get on it. And so at first here, the focus of that is conventional, but there are also nuclear elements of it. The Russians have rushed into deployment a few missiles that have a hypersonic glide vehicle with a nuclear warhead. We're seeing them working on other types of hypersonic weapons that have nuclear capability, but they tend to be dual capable if nuclear is involved at all. We're seeing the Chinese working on similar systems. They've even deployed already what appears to be a glide vehicle of some sort for its rocket force. There's some uncertainty about whether it's nuclear, but hey, they're certainly working on that. And the United States is, you know, obviously pointing to them saying, well, they're doing it, so we need to do it. So there's sort of a real crash program on the way to try to develop these capabilities. So we're probably going to see some kind of hyperglide or hypersonic capability for long-range bombers, as well as for submarines and some surface ships. So this is really happening. Now, How much does that change? Does it make the world more dangerous? It certainly does in, I think, the regional scenarios where the timelines and the reaction time to these weapon systems will be much shorter. And so that will put all sides on their toes and be more nervous about what's going on, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
At the strategic level, I think it has less impact compared to the type of forces that are out there already now. So I think it's more in the region you see this dynamic.
Yeah. Well, it seems like the reaction time thing is everything, right? If we have half an hour to decide if we're really being nuked to death, then that's already not very much time. But if we have 5 minutes, then essentially they're almost guaranteed to choose believing the threat and reacting to it, to err on the safe side, kill us all.
Right, exactly. It's the worst of scenarios because, you know, all side inevitably get into this, they corner themselves, they paint themselves into this corner of worst say, case scenario, always have to assume and plan for the worst, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, stability becomes much more brittle in that scenario. And it bothers me. It's really, I'm really confused why military powers want to go down that route, and because it decreases their security and that of their allies.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm a bit of an extremist on this topic, but I wonder how far you go with me on the idea that Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush, as much as they did to negotiate away our nuclear weapons stocks back then, that Bill Clinton right then could have picked up where they left off and negotiated an end to the entire global nuclear arms race and complete disarmament at that point, with the threat of the Soviet Union and world communism over, that they could have just called the whole thing off. They didn't have to be this way at all. We could have, I don't know, 10 nukes each just to make sure nobody fights, and then that's it. But instead, it was just sort of like we're talking about with this New START deal, that, hey, we get to build a whole new nuclear weapons factory. That'll be expensive. And the whole thing becomes a self-licking ice cream cone, even though we're not talking about M16s. We're talking about H-bombs, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this business has a lot of sort of self-serving dynamic in it, an element of that, absolutely. There were huge opportunity missed after the Cold War ended, where, like you say, we could have fundamentally changed the role that nuclear weapons play and reduced arsenals around the world. Didn't happen for a variety of reasons, and mistakes were made on all sides about this. And here we are. Now we're seeing an invigoration of the role of nuclear weapon and an increase of them. People or countries are rattling the nuclear sword at each other again in a very overt way. So things are definitely going back. But I can't help sort of remark also that one curious fact about the way that nuclear reductions happened. I've looked at this closely, and it's really interesting to see that the periods where most cuts or the biggest cuts happened all were during the Republican presidents. Mm-hmm. and there's a dynamic between the White House and the Congress about why that is so.
Yeah. Only Nixon can go to China, that kind of thing.
Right. That's right. And Democrats can have to be tough and all that kind of stuff and can't be seen to be weak and so forth. But I just want to mention one other thing. I think on the issue here of nuclear weapons, I think it's important to think about the problem or the issue of nuclear weapons, not just as nuclear weapons in isolation, because the role they play and the reasons for why countries have them also have a lot to do with how they perceive the threat from conventional capabilities. So countries will use nuclear weapons to some extent to compensate against what they think are inferior conventional forces. So there's a much more complex dynamic going on in terms of what shapes the direction the nuclear forces take and what countries think they can do to reduce their role. Mm-hmm. So one of the things we're seeing right now that is in the context of the nuclear nonproliferation treaty, the nuclear powers in that, the P5s, as they call, that's the United States, Russia, Britain, France, and China, they've sort of found that, you know, a common theme where they're trying to say to the other non-nuclear weapon states, which is the predominant numbers of countries in that treaty, that, wait a minute, guys, it's not just about us. It's not just about nuclear. You also have to work to create the security conditions in the world so that it is possible to reduce the role and eliminate nuclear weapons. So they're trying to, you know, pass, they're trying to pass some of the responsibility onto other countries as well.
Yeah. All right. I'm sorry. I could do this all day, but I got to go. But thank you so much for your time, Hans. It's really been great.
Great. Thanks for having me.
All right, you guys. That is Hans M. Christensen. He is Associate Senior Fellow with CPRI's Nuclear Disarmament, Arms Control, and Nonproliferation Program and Director of the Nuclear Information Project at the Federation of American Scientists. And check out CPRI's new 2020 yearbook on global arms and especially on nukes here at CPRI.org. All right, y'all, and that has been Anti-War Radio for this morning. Again, I'm your host, Scott Horton, from antiwar.com and the author of the book Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan. Check out my full interview archive, more than 5,000 of them now, going back to 2003, at scotthorton.org and at youtube.com/Scott Horton Show. I'm here every Sunday morning from 8:30 to 9 on KPFK, 90.7 FM in LA. See you next week.